You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.
Episode 54, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in a fun and informative format where you can learn about what physicians face through expert analysis. In today's episode, I'm joined by my new friend, the delightful Stephanie Slade, managing editor at Reason Magazine. And today we're going to venture outside of what we ordinarily talk about in the show, and we're going to talk about abortion. But specifically, we're going to be talking about the interplay on the legal aspects of what is and is not allowable for institutions to engage in when it comes to medical care. This obviously is an ancillary, would involve the physicians and nursing staff and what their roles and obligations are to controversial or sometimes morally objectionable to certain people. We're going to be talking about the ACLU specifically and their legal challenges to Catholic hospitals in the United States. We'll then, as is usual per the show, drift off into a little conversation about the politics and the overall state of the nation as far as it comes to abortion, where the abortion laws are, and what Stephanie believes is going to be the future of the abortion debate going forward, and the possible ramifications of Supreme Court decisions coming down the pike. And just as in episode 53, I have another captive hostage here for this interview while attending Acton University in downtown Grand Rapids, sponsored by the Acton Institute. Acton University is an opportunity for those individuals who are interested in connecting good intentions with sound economic principles. This is essentially a faith-based economics convention of sorts, where you can learn more about the intersection of your faith and how it affects the other parts of your life, both domestic and international policy, social thought, history, and economics. The favorite part of the conference for me, obviously, is the opportunity to interact with these lecturers who will then take the classes alongside you throughout the 3 days. And as people know who go to conferences, generally you learn more outside the classroom than you do inside. I always find the funny thing about this conference for me is most of the people, of course, are PhDs in theology or divinity, and I always have to introduce myself as the other type of doctor here, and also one who hasn't written any books or written any dissertation papers. But anyway, you can find more about that at acton.org, and then you can scroll down to the Acton University tab. The next university or conference will be in June of 2020, back in Grand Rapids. And if you do stop by, make sure you send me a note so that we can connect at some point during the breakfast or lunch. I'd love to have the opportunity to meet some of my listeners. As always, the show notes can be found at theparadox.com/054. There you can sign up as well to get regular notices of things that I'm sending out, which for the most part have been just announcements of the show coming out. You can also visit my Patreon page, where you can support the show. It gives you the opportunity to find links to other appearances I've made in other podcasts, which are totaling about 10 now, I think. But if you don't want to bother with that, you can certainly just go to the Twitter feed, find me at The Paradox Show, and that's P-R-A-D-O-C-S, and there you can get live action and find out what's going on as far as medicine and my other appearances on other shows. Finally, if you've not yet subscribed to the show, please do so on your favorite podcast player, and continue to recommend the show to your friends and family and colleagues. I appreciate all the support. And with that, I'd like to introduce a discussion on abortion with Stephanie Slade from Reason Magazine. Enjoy. Well, hello. I'm here with my new friend, Stephanie Slade, delightful woman who's the managing editor at Reason Magazine, contributing writer at American Magazine. We're here again at Acton University, so I have her captive here at the conference. We're going to talk about something a little unconventional for my show, but we're going to talk about, I guess, the politics and the some of the legal aspects that go along with some aspects of medicine. So first, I'm so used to that. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to talk about the piece you wrote last year called Why is the ACLU Targeting Catholic Hospitals? And so why don't you go into sort of the backdrop of what that article's about, and then we'll kind of go from there, I suppose.
Yeah. So this is a sort of controversy that's been brewing for a few years. It goes back at least to 2013 when the ACLU and a group called Merger Watch put out a report that just was like sounding the alarm at this horrifying development, which is that there are too many Catholic hospitals in this country. And this was troubling from their perspective because, as you may guess, Catholic hospitals run by, you know, affiliated with the Catholic Church, have some rules about the types of procedures and quote unquote care
sure.
that they're willing and not willing to provide. So things like not doing abortions, that's an obvious mm-hmm. one. Also not doing elective sterilization procedures. If somebody has a particular malady and needs, you know, for her, if she has, you know, cancer or something and there needs to be a hysterectomy, that's not what we're talking about. But if somebody just says, I have had two kids and I want to stop now, I want you to sterilize me, Catholic hospitals that are following the directives of the Catholic Church won't do that. And also some therapies associated with transgender folks too, where they, sure. they're demanding access to certain surgeries and treatments. That's not an option at a Catholic hospital. And so from the perspective of some people on the political left, too many Catholic hospitals means too many places where people can't get the treatment that they think they deserve and that this is a problem. And so they've started launching a series of lawsuits trying to force these hospitals to provide this again, quote right. unquote care.
Right. And so we're talking about the care, like a salpingectomy. That's, you know, oftentimes you have to have your ovary removed for some reason, like you mentioned cancer. That would obviously be okay. But the Catholic hospitals, and we'll just kind of say religious, although essentially we're talking about Catholic hospitals at this point.
But it could be other,
there
yeah.
are, well. But pretty much the Catholic Church is the one that's the main sort of driver. Although I don't know if it's a church necessarily anymore with like Trinity Health and stuff like this, was their Catholic leadership. May not get their dictates from the Catholic Church itself.
The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has put out a document, a set of directives that Catholic affiliated and Catholic owned hospitals are supposed to abide by, that governs these questions. So so they are supposed to be, and generally speaking, the bishop of the location that the hospital is in has some oversight responsibility to ensure that the hospital is operating in accordance with those directives.
Right. And I think to back up a little bit further, if we want to look at the history of hospitals, I mean, most hospitals, when you look at the turn of the century or even before in the 1800s, they were philanthropic institutions. Generally, they were through a church or some civic organization. I interviewed Dr. Phil Booth, who was talking about the NHS in Britain. And there are a few Catholic hospitals, not many, and they got some exemptions, so they actually were outside the NHS system because they were such a small percentage in England. Obviously, it's much the Catholics were sort of driven out. It was mostly Anglican, but. Why don't you just go through, if you have the idea of the history of, I guess, the church and hospitals in the United States, and then sort of go from there, move on to the discussion.
Yeah, some of the research I did in preparing to write this article was fascinating. I found that, especially in this country, and sort of in the new world, as we were settling a new continent, there was all this need for services on the frontier, both hospitals and schools and orphanages and things like that. And very often the people who stepped in to fulfill those services were actually Catholic sisters. So members of women religious, you know, members of religious orders, mostly Catholic, who would travel out to these. It sounds kind of crazy, but they would travel out to these frontier communities and they would establish a hospital or a clinic or a school or what have you.
Sure.
And so many of the oldest hospitals in the country are faith-based. They were founded by Catholic religious sisters, and they were providing services when there was no one else to do that. It was either, you know, it was either somebody come in and offer care as a sort of act of charity and service, or these people would go without.
Yeah, it is hard for us to envision now in 2019. And even anyone within two generations of us, we have a fairly modern healthcare system. Even in 1960, it was much more. It was nothing like it was at the turn of the century, right? And it is hard to imagine, really, only 130 years ago, let's say, there was a frontier. I mean, in many ways, there was areas with no civilization. And so if anyone needed care for anything or any sort of, there were no formal institutions most of the time. And so the church or those who were looking for mission work today go to Malaysia or Burma or wherever. I mean, then they were going to, you know, Wyoming or what,
exactly.
Right? I mean, so they had to fill those roles were not being filled by the civil society in that area because it was poor or rural or, you know, just didn't exist yet.
Right, exactly. And plus they were also dealing with different types of medical issues at the time. So essentially plagues, right?
Right, yeah.
These were highly contagious diseases that often these women religious were nursing patients through malaria and whatever else. And there was stories about Catholic doctors and nurses, they contracting leprosy. But they felt like this is for the glory of God. And so they weren't worried. There's stories about how some of the more professional doctors were, they wanted the sisters as their nurses because they were fearless, they said.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I guess a modern equivalent, like Doctors Without Borders, where you're almost in a war zone delivering care in a way, again, without concern about your own safety. Right. I mean, so it's probably a different calling as far as what motivates you, but essentially I guess it's the same sort of thing. So we'll now back up to the present and we look at this controversy. I've been looking for someone to talk to about the conscientious objecting thing, and this is not exactly it, but there's definitely a question when it comes to medicine, you know, what is the obligation for someone who's providing healthcare? If you're a physician or nurse, what are you required to do? I mean, there's a morality question, I think, you know, which is maybe a little different than this question, because this is more, we're going to focus more on the legal one right now. The legal distinction of why is a hospital different than a school, for instance, because a Catholic, you know, Catholics run adoption agencies, they run schools, they run churches, or not obviously churches, but I mean, and hospitals. So how does the ACLU in this case, or I guess, you know, advocates, why do they see healthcare is different than, say, going to a Catholic school and saying you have to teach X, Y, or Z?
It's important to recognize that although these lawsuits have been coming fast and furious for a number of years now, they haven't been successful. And there's a reason they haven't been successful, and it's because there's really no legal grounds. I mean, it's a weak case that they're trying to make. Their claim is that if you want to operate a hospital and you're opening your hospital to the public, then you have to do everything. I mean, it's actually, I interviewed Carol Keehan. She's actually a sister, a religious sister, and she also heads up the Catholic Health Association, so the overarching group that oversees all of these different Catholic mm-hmm. hospitals. I interviewed her for the story, and she was saying, like, it's actually crazy because everybody understands that there's some hospitals that don't do some things.
Sure.
Different hospitals specialize. Some different hospitals are different sizes and are able to, you know, to offer a wider array of services than others. And nobody walks into a hospital that doesn't have a neurosurgery department and says, I demand that you do neurosurgery on me because you have an operating room.
Nor would you want to, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly. But that does seem to be the argument they're making. And it's also very often couched in terms of discrimination, which I don't think is a legitimate a charge to lodge here. But they'll say you're discriminating against women mm-hmm. By not providing them with these services.
Because there aren't really any equivalent male services that are not, right?
I mean, well, it's not elective sterilization, right? That
sure, I guess if vasectomy, sure. Yeah, so, but as far as, I mean, fundamentally what we're talking about is we're talking about abortion, right? I mean, if it weren't for abortion, I don't really think the ACLU would be banging the doors of the hospital saying, we demand that you sterilize people.
Well, maybe not, but now the new hot issue is these transgender, what they call gender-confirming care, mm-hmm. surgeries and therapies.
Right.
And so that's now, that's the new frontier. It's almost the hotter issue than even abortion.
Well, sure. And I would say it's been interesting, but I've been noticing just in my own care. I mean, I've seen a lot more of it. We're doing hysterectomies. We're doing, and we're doing mastectomies. I mean, depends, you know, who's coming through the door. And even in an area where I practice, I would say it's not an area you would expect to have a huge demand for this sort of service, but we are seeing a lot. Now, maybe we're drawing from a larger area because we're a large health system, but I've talked to people in other places of the country, and they're seeing it as well. And so I guess the question is, you know, is you can make an argument, I guess, more easily with abortion. You can say, well, there's a question whether you're taking a life, you know, and that's sort of the fundamental question I feel when it comes to abortion. Is it a life? Is it not a life? And are you taking it? Whereas in this case, it's sort of like, are you just doing a cosmetic surgery or not, right?
Right.
And so do you think that changes the legal argument at all?
I don't know if it does, actually. Although abortion is a hot button issue in a way that some of these other procedures aren't. Ultimately, this is the First Amendment question. And mm-hmm. so that's the grounds on which these cases have been decided so far, which, again, have essentially unanimously come down on the side of the hospital systems, these Catholic hospitals and hospital systems. The judges have said, like, we may even agree. We may even want to side with the ACLU, but the First Amendment is the First Amendment, and it says what it says. And so we just can't find a legal rationale that makes sense to allow us to side with the ACLU. I'm part of the legal argument that the ACLU and their allies are making is that this is especially, their side is especially strong, they say, in communities where there is only one hospital, and that's a Catholic hospital. Mm-hmm. And they say, well, okay, maybe if there's a bunch of hospitals to choose from, our case is weaker, but if there's only one hospital in the community, and you have to go, it's something like if it would take you more than 45 minutes to get to the next nearest hospital, well then surely you should not have to travel 45 minutes to get an abortion.
Right.
Which I still obviously think that's a very weak and questionable argument, but that's one of the things they're saying, and I think that they're able to, there's more they can garner more sympathy when they can say, well, there's a sole provider of care in a community. If that's a Catholic hospital, then maybe the hospital has some extra obligations that could outweigh the First Amendment. But the courts have said, no, the First Amendment outweighs even that case that they're making.
Right. So the access issue is not even enough for them at this point to get. And it's interesting because I think if you look at Europe which is probably where this, I mean, I'm sure the same arguments have been had in Europe, but there's that First Amendment is very unique to the United States, right? I mean, it provides protections for religious institutions and for individuals to sort of do more what they want to do and what they feel like your obligations are less, I suppose, right?
Right. But, you know, on the conscientious objector point, I do think there is a limit to the First Amendment that is worth acknowledging, and that actually sometimes people on the right on this issue maybe go too far on, I think, which is, on the one hand, I think that that to force a hospital or a clinic to do procedures that you know, the owner has conscience-based objections to is clearly a violation of the Constitution. But there's another thing, which is, what if you have a public hospital that is employing people, should its employees have the right to claim conscientious objector status? Mm-hmm. Should a doctor be able to say, I don't do abortions? And what if you have a private hospital that wants to offer those services? Is that private hospital required under the law to employ people, even if those people say, well, I disagree and I want an exception? And I'm not so sure that I can get behind the government stepping in and forcing a private hospital or clinic to have to employ people. I mean, I'm very pro-life, but if we are in a legal regime where abortion is legal, and if a clinic wants to offer abortion, I don't like the idea. I'm very uncomfortable with the idea of the government saying, well, you must hire people even if they're going to refuse to offer one of the services that you as the owner of this clinic or hospital wants to offer.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So shouldn't it be, ultimately, I think that I'm also a libertarian, so I'm one of the unusual pro-life libertarians out there, but...
Not that unusual, I think.
I think there are more than for a long time people believed there were more of us.
I feel like, I don't think it's a 50-50, but it's a 60-40 split, I bet.
Could be. But I think that actually the libertarian sort of respect for property rights solves this problem more easily, because I think if we're going to be on the side of an employer who says, I don't want to pay for birth control, or an employer or a business owner who says, I don't want to bake a cake for a gay wedding because I don't believe in it, if we're going to side with these sort of business owners and employers on the grounds that the business is their property and they should have the right to run it the way they want to, then I think we probably also have to extend that same freedom to a business owner or an employer that says, like, I only want to hire people who share my pro-choice values, you know?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, if you're a small hospital, let's say, and you're going to provide a service like, let's say, abortion, and And as an anesthesiologist, so I would generally don't have anesthesia services for that procedure. But if there was a procedure that I sort of consciously objected to, would I be compelled to perform it or to assist in it? And I guess I would say I don't think anyone's compelled to assist in whatever they think is morally objectionable. But it's probably not unreasonable for that hospital or clinic or to say, well, if you are unwilling to do what's done in this place, you're no longer either welcome here, or maybe at a minimum, you have to find some way of alleviating this. So find someone else. If you're not willing to do it, is your partner willing to come by and do that procedure? And so what we'll see in our here in Grand Rapids, we have a Catholic hospital here in town that's actually not, our group doesn't provide coverage for, but we will see the sterilizations that come from, you know, the woman's given birth 2 days ago or 3 days ago. And sometimes even the obstetrician who delivered in that other hospital will come and very rarely comes to our hospital, but has privileges so they can come and do the tubal ligation, you know.
Right.
And I'm sure the hospital knows that they're doing this, and they don't probably object to that process, but it's just like, as long as it's not our institution, we're okay with that. But maybe I think most of these things can be worked out, sort of, you know.
There's a way to negotiate these issues up front in a civil way, and under the sort of contractual, again, legal regime that we have, where, you know, you can say, like, I'm a hospital and I want to hire people. A qualification for a job at my hospital is that you'd be willing to do these things. I'm not going to force you to do these services if you go work somewhere else. But if you want to draw a paycheck from my business, then, you know, you got to be willing to do the thing that we exist to do. And even if I personally, I'm speaking for myself now, even if I think that thing ought not be legal and is not moral, that's a battle we need to win at a sort of cultural level, I think, before we can be demanding that a private person who has a business must employ someone. Because this actually is the flip side of the issue. In some states, they've tried to pass laws that say that business owners may not discriminate against women who have had abortions. Well, what that actually means in practice is if I am a employers may not discriminate. What if I'm an employer who's hiring people to work at my pro-life ministry? Am I allowed to discriminate against a woman who says I'm a proud abortion advocate? of course I should be allowed to discriminate against them. I should be able to decide what qualifications matter for my organization, and we should respect the rights of people on the other side to also, you know, even if we disagree with them and we want to argue with them and tell them why they're wrong, we shouldn't try to use the law to force them to enter into a contractual business relationship with somebody, in this case, a formal employment relationship, against their will.
Right. I agree. And one of the, and something that's a little bit unique to hospitals is now, although nowadays most physicians, 70% or so, are employed by the hospital system itself. So one could say they would have contractual obligations to the hospital, the facility. Not long ago, you were basically an independent physician and you would bring your business to a hospital. You may have only one hospital you go to. You might go to a couple. And so you might be someone who would be an obstetrician working at the Catholic hospital and also have at the nonprofit or whatever, the secular, you know, hospital system. And so you may choose to move your business to different places based on what they want to do and what they allow. And so, in some ways you kind of, that works itself out as well. So,
and I think it's even more, it's easier for these things to work themselves out the less there are, again, top-down government regulations that, you know, because the market can come up with creative solutions that it would be hard for me to even envision. So, you know, standalone clinics that offer just certain services maybe could be a solution to this problem, but only if the government gets out of the way and doesn't try to regulate those new business arrangements out of existence.
Right. I mean, that's all I talk about in the shows is ways of getting around, not getting around the government, but I mean, just finding disruptive, innovative solutions for solving problems. And there are lots of docs doing things. One of the interesting aspects of this is, you look at the regulations, rules that have been imposed on the Catholic ministries, like the adoption agencies in Europe. And I think one of the expectations by those who advocate for forcing people to do certain things, like the Catholic Church in this instance, is the assumption that once they win, the church will capitulate and do it. And it, we, as you look at Europe, they said, you got to, you know, we have these new rules for adoption. And the Catholic Church said, okay, we just close them all down, which I'm sure was not the expectation, right? I don't think anyone would be advocating for all these things. And suddenly these hospitals just, okay, we're just, and they close the doors. I mean, it's not unreasonable to think the Catholic Church would do that, right?
Right. And what's crazy is that, you know, again, like I said, one of the arguments being made as well, this is, it's especially important that we force these hospitals to do what we want when they're the sole provider of hospital care in a community. But what that really means is no other hospital has been able to figure out how to stay afloat in these rural communities, mostly rural communities.
Sure, yeah.
The Catholic Church is willing to sustain losses in order to keep hospital care available in these places. And if you try to force the Catholic Church to endorse abortion and to perform abortions, the Catholic Church is going to close its hospital, and there's going to be nobody providing care in these places. It's not going to be, I mean, it's not going to be good for the people on the ground there. It's going to be much worse.
Right. And even in a city like ours, where we have a couple of hospital systems, to lose a third of them is not going to be advantageous to us. And ours tends to serve more of the underserved and a lot of the trauma and things like that. So those people just no longer have a place to access and get care. And I think actually one of the court cases actually was specifically the hospital system here in Grand Rapids, I think was. So I guess with the ACLU, what sort of standing do they have? Or do they just find someone and they just help support their case?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
So they're not technically, they're representing mostly women who have, for example, delivered a baby or, you know, given birth and then wanted to be sterilized, and then the hospital has said, you know, you can't do that here. We can transfer you to another hospital, but we can't do that here. And they've said that the fact that they had to wait even, you know, a day or two,
right,
and go to,
right,
another hospital counts as, you know, severe emotional distress, and therefore they should be required to have, get, you know, they were denied care and necessary care, I guess, that they should have been given, and that, so the ACLU is representing these women, and they have had at various times entire like campaigns, websites that they put out where they say they encourage or solicit women to come and tell them their story, and so that they can pick the most sympathetic sounding, you know, potential plaintiff.
Well, they're lawyers, right? I mean, it's just like any class action suit. You want to find the saddest case, and
right.
I'm a supporter of the Institute for Justice, and they find the saddest cases to promote the economic liberty cases as well. Like, right, the hair braider who's,
right,
forced to, you know, endure 600 hours of cosmetology training that doesn't actually, you know, involve her trade. Is there a move in any way to go after physicians to force them to be part of this process, or has it just been an institutional sort of attack at this point through legal?
I think the lawsuits have all been against hospitals and hospital systems. But essentially, a thing to keep in mind is that these are individual practitioners as well that would be coerced. So if the ACLU were to win one of its lawsuits, and let's say a court ruled that a Catholic hospital had to perform certain procedures, you know, hospitals don't do things, people do things. And so,
right.
In some cases, the employees at those hospitals may not personally be Catholic, and they might not personally have a problem with it, but presumably many of them are, and many of these doctors and nurses are personally, you know, deeply morally opposed to some of the things, and so that's part of the problem here.
Well, and certainly anytime you're working at an institution or someplace, especially one that has a specific mission, you probably are, it attracts and certain people to gravitate towards working in that place, and they have probably a shared set of values, and right, like even if you force the hospital and the hospital side, okay, we'll stay open because we feel, for some reason, then you still have to find people to actually perform it, and I don't think you can compel people to do that. And now, I suppose the state in some levels probably could. It could say, well, you could just lose your license if you don't, you know, if you pass the state law, which is the next question, right? So there, it feels to me like the last 6 months to a year, things have really sort of been the issue of abortion suddenly being forced to the forefront, where I felt like it really wasn't an issue for about 10 years or so. You see all these states passing laws one way or the other, right? You have, you know, heartbeat laws in the South. You have laws in the Midwest that are, you know, Iowa that are, again, I think it's sort of like a heartbeat law as well. As soon as a heartbeat, that it's no longer illegal to do abortion after 6 weeks. And then you have the other extremes where you have almost the baby's delivered, or I should say fetus. And then at that point, it's still okay to, you know, abort the baby. Do you feel like this? I mean, this is getting pushed to the Supreme Court at this point, right? I mean, yes. At some point, there's no way you can rectify these different laws, right?
Yeah, there was a stasis or an equilibrium that we had been in for a number of years, where both sides felt like, well, Roe v. Wade is the law of the land and it's not going anywhere. And so people weren't thinking very much in terms of those types of legal pushes to pass laws. But because the balance of the Supreme Court has changed a lot in the last couple of years,
sure.
There's now a sense on both sides. I think there's a sense of optimism on the side of pro-life, the pro-life activist community, that perhaps if we can get a case back to the Supreme Court, we might get a different solution than we got in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a sense of panic and just terror on the side of the sort of pro-choice activists who are worrying about the same thing, and they're thinking like everything we've worked for could be lost, and so we, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures, and so that's kind of what's going on here.
It seems unusual to me because I would feel like I understand the thought from pro-life advocates that maybe this is an opportunity to change, to overturn. They can look at, say, obviously, it's nonpartisan, the Supreme Court, but everyone knows, sort of generally speaking, who's conservative, who's not. You never really know how someone's going to rule and how they sort of view the law, whether they're a traditionalist and originalist, or they follow precedents, you know, what sort of their hierarchy of making decisions at the Supreme Court. But I would think if you're someone who's pro-choice, I would think you'd want to try and maintain as low a profile as possible. The last thing you want is to force any sort of decision to be... Because I think if all these cases were going to just restricting abortion in certain states... I think you would think, well, maybe it won't be forced to the Supreme Court, but if I'm going to have the exact extreme opposite, I'm really forcing the issue that now the Supreme Court's going to have no choice but to say we've got to deal with this. I mean,
well, not exactly, actually. I think the southern states that are passing these heartbeat bills, they are intentionally angling to get the cases
up to the
Supreme Court. I think what's happened in New York, which is the main one where one of these bills on the other side became law, what they're actually doing is they're hedging against, if Roe v. Wade were overturned,
I see,
would we have stronger laws protecting the right to abortion on the books at the state level? Because Roe v. Wade, you may recall, is actually, it doesn't say abortion is illegal or legal. It says it restricts the right of states to pass restrictions on abortion.
Right.
So if you repealed Roe v. Wade, it wouldn't just ban abortion overnight. It would just open up the possibility for states to ban abortion. And so New York State and some other places like that said, well, we want to go ahead and get out in front of this one and make it clear that we're not going to be banning abortion in New York State.
And that, I guess that makes a lot of sense, because then you're saying okay. So that if the assumption is that it's going to become a federalist issue, right? We're going to push it back to the states. The states decide, they have their own cultures, their own sort of values. And so we're going to let them experiment and decide how they want to define abortion and life and things like that. So by having these laws, you're staking your claim right now that we are the bluest of blue, the reddest of red states, or whatever, however you want to look at it, right?
Yeah. And I do think that it was a miscalculation. I think probably both sides are miscalculating with these laws. In the case of the New York bill and the similar ones in Rhode Island and Virginia that didn't end up passing this past year, I really feel like this idea of abortion right up until a minute before delivery, even when the mother's health is fine and the baby's health is fine, this goes so far beyond what even people who self-identify as extremely pro-choice are in favor of, that they're not doing themselves any favor by essentially coming out in favor of infanticide. But I also worry that the pro-choice activists are also...
pro-life.
The pro-life activists are also getting a little bit out ahead of where their base is, because even pro-lifers often are uncomfortable with the idea of... I mean, there's just a lot of messiness, and there's a lot of messiness in public opinion around this issue. And so I would be careful. If it were up to me, I would say, let's be careful not to go too fast, because the political backlash could actually make things worse for our cause if we're not careful.
Right. Yeah. It's the Overton window, right? You want to try and remain somewhere in the point that people is a politically acceptable solution. At 6 weeks, you're looking at people are only at that point sort of getting a positive pregnancy test. And so, yes, the fetus has developed quite a bit, and it's certainly not viable outside, but it does make it's more complicated for people, because you're not showing, it's, you know, when you're pregnant and things like that. So, I guess, with the Supreme Court, I mean, how do you feel that would actually turn out? I mean, it's the big speculation, right? Is it something, I think at this point, the Supreme Court is going to address it. Don't you think? I mean,
increasingly it seems likely that they'll have to, yeah.
And assuming nothing changes, which is always a bad assumption, because people die and retire, whatever, what do you think the court would do right now at this point? I mean, is it really that much pro-life versus pro-choice? Yeah. I don't really think it is, but
I wouldn't put money on the Supreme Court, even under its current configuration, which is far more conservative than it has been in a while. I would not put money on them overturning Roe v. Wade. And that's part of the reason that I worry about this strategy, this legal strategy that's being pursued on the pro-life side. Because even if the justices are more sympathetic to that case than they have been in the past, unfortunately, for better or worse, I think the Supreme Court tends to not outrun public opinion very far.
Right.
It wasn't until several years after public opinion polls showed 50-60% support for gay marriage that the Supreme Court reversed its precedent on that.
Sure.
I think that the evidence suggests that the justices, they're willing to push out a little ways, but they're not willing to go all the way to one extreme or the other when it's still a very contentious issue among the public.
Right. And probably in other issues that the public doesn't follow, they're probably able to be more extreme, like on free speech issues, or because most people don't really pay attention to the intricacies of free speech, right?
Yeah, some more technical legal matters, I'm sure nobody could really understand. Most people aren't understanding or following those cases anyway, so they're not as constrained by public opinion. But as a general matter, I think that, and again, you might think this is terrible, they should be following the Constitution and nothing else, and it should be irrelevant what the people think, but I don't think that that's actually the way it works in practice.
I don't think there's any question that that's how it worked. And, I mean, like you said, there's been sort of an equilibrium for 50 years almost, right, at this point. And so what happens if you upset the apple cart? Is it going to be okay, or is it going to be sort of, are you going to have factions? It could be much worse and uglier. What's interesting, too, though, is that the number of abortions has been decreasing, and there are less abortions now performed than there were, actually, I think even Roe v. Wade's decision came in place, yet the population's, 100 million more people or something like that. Do you think the driving force to that is an understanding by people what abortion is? Do you think it's just, is it birth control that's more prevalent and Catholics have embraced it more than just sort of natural methods? What do you think this is a tough sociological question, but what do you think the driver of that is?
I think it's a little bit of all those things. I think that technology around ultrasounds certainly plays a role. I think it's much harder to sustain the fiction that, a fetus is a ball of cells and not a human being.
Clump of cells, yeah.
Yeah. Right. So that's part of it. I think probably access to birth control is part of it, much to the chagrin of the Catholic bishops. I think education... is part of it, and the importance of waiting until you're married to get pregnant. Increasingly, there's been a lot of talk among sociologists about how this is one of the keys to, at an individual level, if you want to dramatically increase your chances of flourishing in life, if you wait to have kids until after you're married, that is like the difference. So there's been a lot more talking about that lately, I think, after a number of decades of maybe moving away from talking about things like that.
Right. Well, and I feel like even like with other societies in, Japan or Europe, people are waiting longer to get pregnant, for one thing. And there's less just underage. I think there's less underage. There are way less underage pregnancies. Right. I mean, and by that, I mean like under 18. And it almost seems like that is the primary reason that the birth age has gone up so much. And so it probably has not changed much for people who are adults as much as there aren't kids getting pregnant as much as in the past.
That's right. That's my understanding of the data.
And that's a cultural phenomenon probably, I suppose. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't exactly have an explanation. What I think is funny is how there was all this hand-wringing about how, teen pregnancies, and now suddenly there's all this hand-wringing that the kids aren't having sex the way they used to.
Right.
And
I think we need people.
Sometimes I think like the New York Times will never be satisfied with anything. They're always going to have to think that everything is a panic because so they can write these stories.
Well, if it bleeds, it leads. And if there's nothing bleeding, we got to talk about something.
We got to pretend that it is.
Right. What do you, I guess, what do you think the future is for at least the Catholic hospitals? Because it sounds like it not only, maybe at this point, the abortion issue is sort of, there's precedent, at least a legal precedent, so it's probably harder to bring a case up at this point.
Continuing to try.
Sure, but I mean, I think at this point, you've got to see the writing on the wall, right? I mean, it's not probably going to change much unless you have some new compelling, or you get, I guess, get the right judge or something like that. But the transgender thing is certainly more interesting in the sense that it's a newer phenomenon. Is that something they're starting to push, or is there not a lot of...
There's been a number already of lawsuits brought against, like, again, mostly Catholic hospitals for not providing what they call gender-confirming care. And they so far have not been successful, as far as I know. But they're going to keep trying. I don't see any indication that the ACLU and their allies are going to just say, like, well, we tried, we failed, let's move on to some other issue. I think they're going to keep coming. And the thing that makes me nervous is that as the culture changes around this issue and people become more accepting of the idea of, transitions and mm-hmm. whatnot,
yeah.
The cultural bulwark against a legal ruling going against hospitals becomes eroded. So there's a legal bulwark, which is the First Amendment. There's also the cultural bulwark, which is people don't want to, it doesn't seem right to them that we should be forcing people, a Catholic hospital to provide these services.
Right.
But if it gets to the point where everybody, nobody bats an eye over the trans issue more broadly in the culture, then it's much easier for a sort of activist judge, so to speak, to hand down that ruling. So I worry that that's the direction we're going.
I mean, I think personally, I feel like it's going to, it would be not hard to find a surgeon who's unwilling to do a double mastectomy, who does it for breast cancer, and take them to court. Yeah. I mean, I think that's, maybe I shouldn't be out providing legal advice, but I feel like that's where the real risk is, because I think the hospital is, they've got lots of money, but you can take on individual practitioners and really, I don't know. I mean, I think that's a significant risk.
Yeah. I'm not sure if there have been any lawsuits brought against individuals. I'll have to look into that.
But I don't know. Is it any different than the baker, or the photographer, or whatever?
Unfortunately, no.
Right. I mean, it feels like the same sort of thing, right? Like I'm denying you some service that I provide anyone else because they had cancer, but you're just wanting it because we do mastectomies prophylactically for people who have a history of breast cancer in their family, and all I want is because I think I'm a man, and so I want the. I mean, I don't know how. I think, people can say there's moral differences, and I think you can make an obvious argument for that. But is that compelling enough to say that you can deny someone that your surgical skills?
I don't know.
Environment?
I don't know, because I would never have believed that the lawsuits trying to and the legal crusade to force bakers to make cakes for gay weddings would get as far as it did. I mean, fortunately, it does seem like that was resolved on sort of the side of sanity so far. I agree that it seems analogous, and probably we are going to start to see this case being made on the grounds you're describing.
So where can people find more stuff that you've written about? I know you're mainly an editor, as you told me earlier, so you do.
Yes,
you do.
I mostly spend most of my time doing behind-the-scenes work for Reason magazine, but I also do write sometimes for Reason, and you can see my stuff at reason.com, and I also occasionally contribute to America magazine, which is a Jesuit magazine. So you can also, Google America Magazine and see some of my things there, including the article I wrote about the ACLU lawsuits against Catholic hospitals.
Right, and that will be linked in the show notes at The Paradox. That's docs.com. And obviously you tweet too.
Yes, so at SladeSR. So please absolutely follow me, engage with me on Twitter. I'd love to hear from some of the listeners.
And from what I've learned over the last couple of days, she loves polling and she thinks it's great and super accurate.
It can be. You just got to use it well. I worked in the polling industry for a few years before I started at Reason. But I'm also a little bit critical of the way that sometimes people twist the polling numbers to get the results they want.
Well, and before we close it, that actually is interesting too, because we always, we're here talking about how we think that, it's more acceptable to, or the people feel a certain way about abortion or various issues. It's probably harder to gauge where the nation stands on anything, right? Because if we think polling's less accurate, if I'm looking at Twitter or I'm looking at Facebook or I'm looking at the nightly news or something to try and gauge where is the public on whatever issue, I mean, do we have like a silent majority like with Nixon claim? Do we have, I mean, how do we really know where people stand on various things, right?
I would actually, so although I have been I've been critical of people who put too much stock in polls. The polls that are most unreliable are the ones that are trying to predict how people are going to vote in a future election.
So predicting the future.
Right. The polls, the research that's conducted by people like Gallup and Pew Research Center and you know, various universities, where they're just trying to gauge where is the public stand on a particular issue right now, I think is more reliable. So I'm not, I think that many of the methodological problems that make so-called horse race polling, you know, pre-election prediction style polling, not reliable at all, don't apply. They don't apply nearly as much to the sort of temperature gauging polls of, you know, where does the public stand at this moment on this issue? There still are problems. You know, people aren't as likely to answer the phone and all of that. That's definitely true. But it's easier to correct for those because we know we can sort of weight the numbers according to census data, and the demographic makeup of the country is pretty well known. It's a given. But the future demographic makeup of the electorate, who's going to actually show up on election day, that we don't know in advance. So pollsters just have to guess when they're weighting the data in those cases.
Sure. And I always feel like, especially with election, it's tough to determine what motivates people, and they don't even know what's going to motivate them in 2 months, and what and the sort of calculations they make is strategically sort of what they're
going to do. Everybody says their likelihood of turning out to vote is like a 9 out of 10, but 90% of people do not turn out to vote, so that they're either lying or they're just wrong.
All right. Well, thank you, Stephanie, so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what The Doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.